see. So you're saying firms would need to adapt themselves and be well capitalised?
Yes, they'd have to be very well capitalised to cope with the commercial pressures that the clients would put upon them. And as a result of that, no doubt, a lot of mergers that went on in the industrial jobbing market during the period from 1950 onwards. And it was clear that there would be five or six winners at the end of the day. And Wed Jefferson, as they were then, Delacca, Mordant, Bone, Oldham and Seal, CD Pynchon and Co., Ackroyd and Smithers were clearly firms who, Bisgood and Bishop, Smith Brothers, as they were then, were all firms who were beginning to make mergers and acquisitions across markets and build up their capital.
Can you describe how your father set about adapting the firm to the new post-war conditions?
Well, I think that one of the things that he did was to bring organisation to it. He, of course, essentially the business of a jobber was an individual business that he as a principal stood with his book on the floor of the exchange, and as the charter of the stock exchange was written, their clients were simply the brokers. Very, very similar to Lloyd's in many ways, that the brokers went out into the world to bring the business to the market, in return for which the market never tried to go out into the world to compete for the business. A very clean, simple approach to life. The brokers went out into the world, brought back the business, and the world in essence, of course, in those days was essentially the UK, but there were strong overseas markets, such as the gold market, prior to the war, the American market, the Australian market. And although they had exchange controls and peculiarities according to their own, nevertheless, a substantial amount of that business was brought back to the London market to be handled and transacted by the jobbers there. And so the jobbers had a tremendous personal relationship with the brokers with whom they dealt. You had to do that in order to trust, be entrusted with the business that you were given or that you wished to take on, because if somebody chose to do you wrong, as it were, you could become very financially upset as a result of it. So it was a tremendous mutual trust. Of course the clients had their business done properly, but at the same time you had to trust the agent who was bringing that business to the market, that it was properly brought and that there was no difficulties about it and that it was perfectly clean. Mm. You didn't obviously make money out of every transaction, but you had to know that there was no crookedness or anything going on at the back end, and you therefore had to trust your brokers.
Did your father pursue a similar policy of merger to that pursued by people like Esmond Delacca and Hugh Merriman?
Yes, he did. His first sort of merger, I would have said, was with a small firm in the industrial market, and then there were several firms in the rubber market. Then I think the first big merger was with Messrs. Ferguson and Clark, which was actually at the moment that I came into the business, and they were in the financial markets. And after that, there were mergers with Merton and Adams in the paper market, and then the last big merger that they undertook was with Denny Brothers in the investment trust market.
How did these mergers come about?
Mainly by personal contact between one senior partners. I mean, there were clearly only four or five people who were at that stage in the business of bringing the major jobbing units together. And it was a question of how the individuals got on with the other senior partners and how they thought that their staff and their employees would be looked after. So it became a very much a sort of personal performance. Equally, one has to say that you tried to keep it in markets. I mean, you didn't start stepping outside something you didn't know about, unless there was a very good reason for it. I would say that probably Wed Dalakka were the most adventurous in the sense that they really took anything on. Mm. I think we stuck rather more rigidly to markets which we felt we knew about.
Mm-hmm. Did your father know people like Hugh Merriman and Esmond Dalakka personally?
Would yes,
they, did they,
very
would
much.
They discuss
oh, yes.
the jobbing system writ large together?
Yes, very much so. And although they were fiercely competitive with each other and their staff were fiercely competitive with each other, I think it would be fair to say that at the top level there was a very good understanding. I mean, maybe in retrospect that's more apparent than real, but I would say there was no, it was honourable competition and you could always speak to your opposition. It was a very fine way of doing business.
Well, let's return to your career. When exactly was it that you joined Pynchon? Or even...
I think it was in 1966 that I joined Pynchon. I will.
And you said that you found it quite hard being back down at the bottom again. What exactly were your first jobs in the firm?
I think one of the first things that I had to do was to go and buy peppermints for the partner who was running the pitch to whom I was allocated. And I simply couldn't stand it. And after about a month of this, I turned around to him one day and said, if you want any peppermints, you can bloody well go and buy them yourself.
His
response to that was to take me outside and give me the biggest dressing down to say that unless I towed the line and behaved myself, that he personally didn't see there was any future for me in the firm whatsoever. So I had, my father never entered the argument whatsoever. He just left me to sort it out. And I have to say that we came to a good understanding in that I didn't go and get his peppermints every day, but I did once a week.
So were you sent straight onto the floor of the house?
Yes, straight onto the floor of the house as a blue button, as a junior trainee. And I was there for probably 6 to 9 months learning the trade. And looking back on it, humility about buying the senior partner peppermints was one thing, but you did make your friends amongst your fellow blue buttons, and you not only within the firm but amongst the brokerage. We used to go out to coffee with each other, and some of the people I used to have coffee with when I was 23, 24 are now people who either have been or are still senior partners of the broking firms. Mm-hmm. And like anything in life, you make your friends at that stage. So it was an invaluable experience. And the Stock Exchange was a great leveller. If you got a bit too big-headed or cocky, something happened to knock you down. And the personalities inside it were terrifically observant, and any idiosyncrasy that you might have had, they used to pick on at once, and they'd give you the most immaculate nickname, which was rude without being offensive, but just brought home to the fact that something that you might have been doing, which was annoying to your fellow colleagues, was spotted and alighted upon. A great leveller. And if you couldn't take it, and you couldn't take the sense of humour, well, then quite honestly, you were better out of it. And I remember many friends who couldn't stomach it. And I think it just sorted you out, really. I mean, either you were made for the market or you were not. Mm. And if you were, it was a good life. If you weren't, well, you better go and do something else.
Do you have any other early impressions or memories of the Stock Exchange? Of course, you're still in the old house.
Yes, very much the old house, yes. There were great characters there. Again, there was a man by the name of Percy Duke who had a very small firm of jobbers, and he was a bully, and he used to take great pleasure in knocking into a blue button and pretending that he'd been doing running or had barged him, because in those days there was great etiquette about how you behaved on the floor of the exchange. because it was a physical market with a lot of people on it, and if everybody ran from A to B, of course you'd have a chaos. It couldn't be worked. So there were strict rules, but some people used to stick by them, and other people would turn a blind eye. And this particular man was a great bully who had a delight. And his business basically was going downhill. So the further it went downhill, the more sticky and difficult he became. And one day, it was at the time of the rebuilding of the stock exchange, he knocked into a young, what he took to be a young blue button, and gave him the most terrific rocket for running. And the chap said, "I don't know what you're talking about, Gov," he said. "I come from Trollope and Coles, the builders." So the laugh was on him. And it was rather sad that at the end of the day, it was actually that particular firm was taken over by my father's firm, and the individual who apparently was at the front of it all turned out to be not half the man he'd made himself out to be. And at the end, he lost his entire capital. So it was a very sad commentary on just how somebody could put on an air and a grace in exchange, and his real life was crumbling away behind him. Mm. So you learned a great deal about human relations, a great deal about the basic things which drive human beings, which I have to say I still think are fear and greed. I saw two dramatic examples of fear and greed in my life on the exchange, and I've never really forgotten them, and I don't think that I ever will see a more graphic examples.
Would you feel able to describe any of those? Or?
Well, very briefly, the two. The fear was in 1974, which was probably the most vicious bear market post-war. Three of us were summoned to the council of the chairman's room in the council of the exchange, and the chairman said, "Well, he just received a telephone call from the chairman of the National Westminster Bank, and the chairman would like to say that he felt that from the market had come a rumour that the National Westminster Bank was going broke, and that the chairman had received this call in order to tell us that this was not the case, that the bank was entirely liquid, could meet any calls that would be made upon it, and would we please go back to the marketplace and make that known." Now, that must be the nearest thing that I shall ever see to being a run on the bank, and as the bank involved was the National Westminster, it was clearly no minnow. And it transpired that indeed one of our dealers had picked up an off-the-cuff comment, had walked into the local branch of the NatWest to cash a cheque, had repeated this comment, which he'd heard on the floor of the exchange. The cashier had repeated it to the manager, the manager had repeated it to the senior manager, and it had whistled up to the top in no time, hence the telephone call. But that just showed one how close to fear people had become. The greed story was really much more basic. It was at the first post-nationalisation of BP, when the shares were offered by the government to the public. And it was a very hot issue. It had gone extremely well. And as a jobber, our firm were not jobbers in the stock at the time, but one observed grown men fighting each other to get to the jobber's stand in order to deal for their clients, and physically being pushed and kicked and shoved for hour after hour after hour. It was quite horrible. Mm. Something I don't really ever wish to contemplate again. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd like to return to the 74 recession and the privatizations just a little bit later in the context of the pensions experience of those particular episodes. But to return back to the early days as a blue button, were you attached to one particular pitch, or were you moved from one pitch to the other?
No, I was moved from one pitch to another. To get an overall view of what was going on in the firm. There were obviously markets which were more important to the firm than other markets, and one, but one had to see all sectors of it. I think my father was one of the first people who decided that fixed interest securities were a market of their own, that although we dealt in the underlying equities of many commercial and industrial firms, that there was a separate market to be made out of the debt which attached to those companies. And he set up a fixed interest department. Now, that wasn't a very glamorous side, but it was a very good bread and butter earner. And one had to do one stint on that side, although you didn't necessarily contemplate being a dealer in that particular market.
Which were the other markets?
The other markets we looked after in those days were electricals, steels, before the first nationalisation. No, I think after the first nationalisation, before the second. My memory fails me, I'm afraid, on that. Engineering. And then as a result of the first mergers, the financial markets of insurance, banking, and associated financial companies. They were really the markets in which we operated. And so one had a good turn around all those. And in those days, there were lots and lots of different companies to deal in. Mm. And we had a very full book of stocks.
Which were the more glamorous stocks or the more glamorous books?
I think the electrical market was the one which my father particularly had sort of singled out, and the stocks there were General Electric, AEI, English Electric, Parsons, Railroad and Company, most of whom I think have subsequently merged or been taken over. Mm. And now GEC would account for practically a lot of them. But in those days, there were thriving markets in all those stocks, and there was a great living to be had out of them, great living to be had out of them.
How did you feel after you'd been a Blue Button a while about the decision to go into the stock exchange?
Well, I think like anybody, you know, you go in to a job and you think that this is going to be your last port of call. But I very seriously thought that I would leave it again, that I didn't, in many ways, having had a professional background, it was very difficult to come up with a rough and tumble of the market that intellectually one felt on a different level. That's not to say a superior level, but just on a different level. I found the sort of humour and the give and take of the market something which I couldn't really get on with. So many people took commercial decisions by the seat of their pants rather than by any sort of judgmental process. And essentially, that is the essence of a jobber. I mean, you couldn't ask him why he did a deal. He just did a deal because it felt right. And it was very hard to actually get that together. Now, my father, you know, again, and his partners, their commercial upbringing was to trust their gut reaction. You had to have a nose for a market. You had to, and that was experience. It was reading the papers. It was all sorts of different things. And people are good at it, or they're not good at it. There's no sort of examination which can say you're good or bad. From a professional background, it was difficult to accept all that, and I did find that for a while I didn't think I was going to make it. However, I did at the end. Mm. But I would say that I was never a good jobber in the sense that my father and some of his partners were. They were good gut feeling jobbers. They had the ability to make money, run a good book, to look after the business. I was certainly not in the same league as they were, as far as that was concerned.
Who were the other important partners in the firm?
Well, my uncle Copper was another very good. He was not as good a jobber as my father, but he was a very good disciplinarian. And although my father, previously in the interview, I said he was a very hard man, a disciplinarian. He was basically an expansionist. And if you asked him a question, he'd always say yes to it. He'd want to be on the front foot always. My uncle was very much more cautious person. And they acted actually as a good pair, because there was always another point of view to a problem that was brought through. And by and large, they got on pretty well. They had their arguments, but by and large, they got on very well. And I think it was that combination which was at the sort of strength of the firm. There was also another man called Bill May who did a very unusual thing in that a merger which had gone on between Wed and actually between Dalacca and other firms was, he didn't like that and he didn't want to go, and he'd always been a great friend of my father's, and so he decided to do a splinter group and come and join my father. Now that was almost unheard of in the stock exchange. It created quite a stir at the time, but they were tremendous personal friends, and Bill May was a terrific, tremendous jobber. He was a great market student. He knew his stocks inside out, and tremendous respect amongst the brokers for the business that he could bring them and the business that they could transact through him. Very, very powerful personality. He probably was another one. The third one was a man by the name of Todd Erling Clark, whose father had been chairman of the stock exchange. In fact, I believe he was the last jobbing chairman of the stock exchange, and was, as such, a complete disaster. And the exchange resolved never to have jobbers as chairman again, but I wasn't there to see that, to verify those facts. But Todd himself was a considerable intellectual personality, very lively, very temperamental, but a real expert in his in the insurance market in particular, and they really ran the five or six major commercial composite companies with very high price shares, like £60 or £70 a time, quite unlike now, with equanimity and ease, and he was a formidable adversary to come across if you were learning your trade.
What was the next step for you after being a blue button?
Well, I was made a junior dealer, I worked, again, well away from my father's electrical book. He wouldn't have anything to do with me, really. He passed me around the partners. I worked for Bill May, and I worked for about a year with him.
Which book was he running?
He was running the television and sort of light electronic stocks at the time. And I really learned my jobbing business from him. He was a great pessimist, Bill. He lived entirely on the basis that everything was going down tomorrow. And he was a genuine bear jobber. It says quite a lot that he managed to be so successful in what, by and large, post-war, certainly from the 50s to the 70s, was an entirely an increasing bull market. But he always ran a cautious book and always ran it on the short side. Very, very judicious user of capital. And it was actually the finest way to run the business for lots of different reasons, which we may no doubt go into later, but he was a great teacher of it. So he taught me to really be a junior dealer, and I did that for a year. And then promotion became pretty rapid because, I mean, clearly at that point I had become accepted within the firm, and although not universally accepted by everybody, I think it was, although I say it myself, assumed that eventually I would progress through the partnership, or into partnership, and then through the partnership, perhaps to be a future boss of the firm. And there was no resentment about that, I would say, from my fellow employees, because they recognised that although he was the boss, it was the question of the boss's son, they rather liked and approved of the idea that provided the boss's son was up to the job, that he should take the lead, mm-hmm. provided it didn't mean that their own ambitions would be blunted. And I think my father was a realistic enough man to realise that his own share, and indeed of the senior partner's equity, would have to be watered down to be given to other people. And although many of these young men had absolutely no capital at all, there was quite a straightforward but harsh formula which allowed them to be partners, essentially borrowing money from their senior partners, and it was repaid out of profits as they were earned. And it was, I think, that knowledge that young that they wouldn't be penalised, which helped me to be accepted, and I think in the end welcomed as somebody who perhaps one day might be the senior partner of the firm.
Mm-hmm. How did other people come into the firm?
Oh, it was a very broad brush. We it got a lot of people from local secondary schools. It was very, I mean, I think people have a great view of the city as being, you know, the blue-blooded battalions and people with public school, university education would come in and take in their father's footsteps, and so it would carry on forever and ever. And to some extent, and I'm a case in point, I mean, that was so. But it was terrifically broad-minded and independent beyond that, and all firms would accept people from any walk of life, and provided they put their best foot forward, they nearly always got recognition. And I would think there isn't a firm, the most blue-blooded of which you could mention, who doesn't have people who came from the very most humble beginnings. It wasn't a meritocracy exactly in all firms, but if you were good at your job, you jolly well came through to the top. I think it's been one of the most obvious misjudgments of the city that it's only the blue bloods can get on. It simply was not the case in the Stock Exchange anyway.
Well, after a year with Bill May as a junior dealer, what was the next step for you?
I then became, very quickly after that, invited to join the partnership. Mm-hmm. And I think I became a partner in 1968-9, something of that nature. And I became a junior partner. And then I began to take responsibility for the administration. I was obviously involved, because of my professional training, I was involved in some of the more specific parts of the business, like the taxation of the firm and so forth. So I had a good grounding in that. But at the end of the day, one's business was dealing in stocks and shares, and one couldn't get away from it. I mean, you couldn't afford battalions of administrators and so forth, and we had no need for it. So your business was from 9:30 to 3:30, and then from 3:30 to 5, dealing on the book, the 3:30 to 5 being after hours, and then at 5 o'clock you started your administration. Mm. And gradually one got involved into the administration as it became more and more heavy.
Mm. Which book were you on?
I think I really did all of them. I was on the engineering side, the electrical side. My father probably in the late '60s had by then given up active dealing and had gone on to the council and a number of other things. So he'd left the actual day-to-day dealing. And I took over the electrical side at some point from him, certainly. But I did all the stocks.
Mm. And about how many of you would be running each book?
Well, you'd have the structure of the firm was one principal or partner to a pitch, and then probably three or four employees on each pitch, and each pitch would represent an industry, which would probably have a lead book of the biggest stocks, and then two or three secondary books with all the minor and lesser stocks on them. So I would say we probably had a staff of sort of on average something like 7-8 people, and we'd have had something like 8 to 10 pitches, something like that. So we had, roughly speaking, 80 dealers, of which you'd have had 15-20 partners, something like that.
What would a typical day be like for you at this stage, say the late 1960s, early 1970s, still a relatively junior partner? For example, where were you living this time?
I was still living in Hampshire at that time. I would probably have. Ours had become a little bit more pressing by then, and I would be catching a train to leave at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I would be in London, probably at about sort of half past eight, quarter to nine, something of that nature. And I would go to the office just to get the day started, as it were. And then we would walk down to the floor of the exchange at half past nine. And then we would deal until half past three, until the official hours finished. And then we would be up in the office from half past three till probably the latest 5 o'clock, when dealings would cease. And the books would be ruled off and the bargains put through in terms of the stock exchange settlement system. And then I would leave and catch the 5:30 home, something like that. But once a week, once a fortnight, we'd have a committee meeting, something like that. And then that increasingly became once a week, and then that perhaps became twice a week. And that meeting would last from 5 till half past 6, quarter to 7. In which case I would probably spend the night in London.